What a year 2020 was. Our court systems had to deal with mainstream media's defaming of a high school kid without bothering to do journalism 101. You know, actually watching the video of the event and getting your facts straight. Yeah, CNN, you might want to watch the tape next time before trying to ruin a young kid's life. Well, our beloved Aunt Becky had to do hard time when she tried to score advantages for her kids. Now, Aunt Becky, you need to learn a lesson here. If you want to bribe your kids' way into college, do it the old-fashioned way. Yeah, donate money to the university so they put your name on a building. Hey, that's a tried-and-true manner. There's a proper way to bribe. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. And finally, we had to deal with people who lick toilet bowls. Yeah, one would think Charles Darwin had some thoughts on this. So today, Mackenzie and I put a cap on 2020 in this week's Debriefing of the Law. Welcome to this week's Debriefing of the Law. I am Joel Oster.
And I am Mackenzie Smith.
See, we timed it out well, Mackenzie. Let's do a new opening where I just say my name and you jump right in. And I was wondering if you were going to nail it. And you did. It's a 10 out of 10. You absolutely nailed. You stuck that landing. So good job there.
I'm a natural.
You really are. So here's what we're going to do today. We are going to have a little bit of fun reviewing the last year in law. So the name of this podcast is Debriefing the Law. So that's what we're going to do here for the last year. We've had a lot of time to reflect. And yeah, it's been a long year. Mackenzie, do you even remember what life was like a year ago today?
I remember being like, 2020 is going to be my year. I'm back at
right,
it.
Right.
Like, yeah, I remember vaguely, but I do feel a little bit like Maggie Smith in Titanic. Like, it's been 84 years. I mean, I feel like I've aged about a decade in the past year. And I think that's like a common sentiment among people that I talk to, at least. Like, it does feel like it was a very, very long, arduous year.
I cannot believe that it was a year ago the Kansas City Chiefs won the Super Bowl. And then after they won the Super Bowl, all hell broke loose. I mean, it seems like society ended. They always said, hey, once the Chiefs won, then maybe it would be like there'd be snowing in hell. I'm not sure. But yeah, it's been a crazy, wild ride. Well, I want to break down this last year when it comes to the legal happenings. And man, did we have a lot. I mean, just to kind of remind you, it was within the last year we had Trump's impeachment proceedings. But nonetheless, it has been a very long year. Before we get there, we got to at least address the New Year's resolutions. We just celebrated the new year. And Mackenzie, are you the type of person that makes New Year's resolutions?
Not really. I mean, I guess amorphously. Like, I do feel like at the end of every year, there's always that weird week between Christmas and New Year's where nothing's really going on. And you're kind of like in your PJs all week. And I do feel like I tend to kind of reflect about what happened that year and kind of try to turn over a new leaf or you know, get organized and clean my house and all that and kind of start fresh. So I like to do that. Like, I meal prepped yesterday, which I normally don't do.
You know what? You started the year off right. Well, I'm going to put you to the test because I asked you that question 8 years ago. And you actually gave a New Year's resolution, I'll have you say. And I want to know, did you accomplish your New Year's resolution?
I have zero recollection of what it was. I can't imagine anything substantive. I'm already so perfect. Like, what could I possibly improve upon? I don't know. I have no recollection of what it even was.
No recollection at all.
I probably did not meet it.
You're going to predict you did not meet this resolution.
That's my prediction.
All right. Well, let me go ahead and play for it for you here. So you can hear yourself a year ago resolving to do something. Let's see what that is here. Well, it is time for New Year's resolutions. The New Year's upon us, and it's time to make New Year's resolutions. And so, Mackenzie, do you have any New Year's resolutions as you look forward to 2020?
You know, this is so hard because I feel like I've always failed when I've actually had like a specific resolution. I think you want to pick something that you can stick to. But that's not too easy to where, you know, you inherently feel like a failure. So I would love to say, like, I'm going to give up wine and watch reality TV and, like, become really classy this year. But like, I would have already broken it because Vanderpump Rules premiered on Tuesday and there I was on my couch. They make really good wine in a screw top now. And every minute of it was amazing. So I didn't even try. So this year I just went with something much more broad and general. And I had a baby last year, which as anyone who has kids knows is like an incredibly joyful experience, but it can also be really isolating and your world becomes
and tiring.
Very tiring. Your world becomes very small for a long time. So my one of my resolutions is, you know, to get back out there, to get outside my comfort zone and to, you know, try new things, this being one of them. So here I am.
I loved it when we had our babies because I learned about all the fascinating TV shows that are on between 2 and 4 a.m. I had no idea that it was such captivating TV on at that time. But now I have a question for you. The other day I was listening to the radio about New Year's resolutions, and someone said his resolution was to resolve not to make any New Year's resolutions. And my thought was, well, did he keep it or did he break it? All right, I don't know if you can hear that, but your New Year's resolution was to be awesome. That's what you said a year ago. Did you accomplish that?
Oh, totally. I mean, it's just so funny now hearing that, thinking back to a year ago, and I can now recall being like, I'm going to get back out there and go to parties and meet new people and be less isolated. And it's like, LOL. But I do have to say, I'm actually, like, hearing that, I now feel pretty proud of myself because I feel like I kind of made lemonade. Like, it was, life did not provide the circumstances that would have allowed anyone to get out there more and try new things, you know.
Right, right.
In terms of meeting new people or going to events or things like that. But I did run a marathon this year, and that was new for me. And I gave up wine for an entire month before I ran it. So I feel like I overachieved in 2020, given the circumstances. So maybe I should resolve to just, like, sit back a little this year.
Well, you know what? We recorded last year, so let's go ahead and put this next year's New Year's resolution on record as well, because guess what? Next year, we're going to come back and review this. But before we do, I do have to ask, what is Vanderpump? I was listening to that, and you said, I just watched my first episode of Vanderpump Rules. I must have missed that during the quarantine. I did not binge watch what is Vanderpump Rules?
You're going to, like, you're going to fire me from this podcast. It's actually a spinoff of The Real Housewives.
Okay.
It's even worse, but actually it has now become not worth watching because they fired a bunch of, this is like a whole nother episode we could do on this. They actually fired a bunch of cast. What it is it's a reality show that follows like the 20 and 30 something waiters and waitresses at, I guess, servers and bartenders at these restaurants owned by one of The Real Housewives.
Okay.
So, you know, they're always like, there's all these shenanigans and they're all dating each other and whatever. It's dramatic. But they actually fired like 4 cast members, 2 of whom were like original, very well-liked cast members this summer for prior like racially insensitive tweets that they had tweeted like years and years ago, I think. I don't know the exact details, but it was like during that kind of time period where a lot of people were getting fired for things like that. And it's very interesting. Like, we could do a whole nother episode on now looking back, like 4 or 5 months after the fact when things have kind of calmed down, at least in that respect, on whether that was kind of too knee-jerky. And I think that the producer has spoken to that in a New York Times article recently, so I won't go over it. But it's, in any event, the cast now stinks and it's not worth watching. So don't waste your time.
Mackenzie, I am scheduling an intervention because apparently you are out of control when it comes to these reality TV shows or series. No, they. I thought that was very interesting, your resolve. I was wondering, did you resolve to run a marathon? Because I know that's what you did this last year. So last year, did you have in mind at the New Year's that, hey, during this next year, I'm going to run a marathon? Or did that come up afterwards?
No, absolutely not. I was barely running at all. And the only reason I started running regularly was because my yoga studio and my gym shut down. So I didn't really have a choice. And then, you know, with not having childcare, like my only option to exercise essentially during the initial lockdown was to take the jogging stroller out and go for runs. So I started running like almost every day with my baby. And then I just kept going. I'm like Forrest Gump. Like I just kept going further and further. And by July I was like, well, I guess I'll just keep going. So well, that's kind of how it worked out.
You resolved to be awesome. You ended up running a marathon. And so now in full disclosure, I resolved to do a podcast every single week. I aimed a little bit lower than what you aimed. You aimed for awesomeness. I aimed for, let me just crank out a podcast once a week. And I ended up with 49 podcasts this last year. So I got close there.
That's pretty good. I think you should be just as proud of yourself as I am. Like that's pretty stellar.
Hey, we're putting ourselves out there. And so let's do that again. I give you a little bit of a heads up saying I want to ask you for your New Year's resolution. If it was to be awesome again, you got to scratch that out. You already used that one. You got to come up with a new one. So what would be your one or two resolutions for this next year?
You know, it's tough, but I guess my number one resolution would be to slow down a little bit. I think I...
Slow down. After the pandemic, the lockdown, you want to now slow down.
You know, that sounds really counterintuitive, and I know that. But I think anyone with four kids who also works full-time will attest that the pandemic, while it made my world smaller in terms of, like, I didn't travel, I didn't really go anywhere, but it made my life crazier. And I've been just going all year trying to take care. You know, I've been a homeschool teacher. I've been a short order cook. I've been an attorney. And I think for this year, what I would love to do is just kind of refocus on, you know, paring down a little bit. And I would love to take a vacation with my husband. If I had to resolve one concrete thing, it's to go away at least for a weekend with my husband by ourselves with no kids and just relax.
I so hear you. That's on my New Year's resolutions as well. I want to travel somewhere. We were supposed to go to Europe this last year. Of course, you know how that ended up. And so this next year, we want to go somewhere. My son right now, my oldest son, is vacationing down in the Virgin Islands. And he's sending me pictures of how beautiful it is down there. And I am so jealous because, of course, you know, I want to go somewhere. Yeah. I'm thinking I want to go somewhere like the Virgin Islands or talk to someone who just vacationed in Mexico. Just find some house on vacation rentals by owner or even Airbnb. Just rent out that house, have it be on the beach for a week. That sounds like a lot of fun. What about you? Do you have any place in mind?
So my husband and I are thinking about going to Mexico, actually, this spring to Cozumel, which is an island. And, you know, it's obviously contingent. Oh, did you like it? Because I've heard really good things and it's very easy to get to. Yeah.
I actually been there twice. And so I love that place. Great food, good hangout spots, very beautiful beaches. You can't go wrong.
Yeah, so it would be contingent on, obviously, you know, things kind of going in the right direction COVID-wise. But I really hope that we are able to do that and get away. And I don't really have any grand ambitions. Like, I'm typically overambitious with travel. I'm like, let's go to Thailand. And ends up being, like, so exhausting. And I think I'm just already, like, pre-exhausted. So I don't even care. Like, I'm like, I don't care if there's culture. I don't care if it's a all-inclusive resort. Like, I just want to go somewhere where I can lay on a beach.
Let's back up here, because I gotta probe a little bit on what you just said. So if, let's say you're going to go on vacation. Are you the kind of person that plans out every minute of the vacation? You have a bugle horn at 6 a.m. to wake everyone up, and you're going until midnight. Is that you, or do you just kind of go there to relax?
No, I'm not a daily itinerary person, but I am ambitious. So like when we went on our honeymoon, I think we were gone for like 9 days, and we went to the Canary Islands and Madrid and Sevilla in Spain, which is a lot. Ah. Like, the Canary Islands are off the coast of Morocco, so it's, like, far. And we did a lot. And I didn't have, like, a daily itinerary, like, we need to do this and then we need to do this. But we were moving around a lot, and I do definitely kind of try to overachieve in terms of what I see. I like to take it all in. So that's typically how I am, and I love to explore new places, but... this year, like, really, I would just love to, I can't believe I'm about to say this, but I would just love to get on a plane and go somewhere, right?
Well, because you and I both have had COVID. So for us, to a certain extent, do you not agree with me that you feel like now the whole world is yours because you've had COVID? You can go out, eat in restaurants now, you know, because you know you can't, for about 3 months, you're going to be immune to it. You can't pass it. You can't get it. You can go back to life as normal. So there's a little bit of freedom now that we are both post-COVID. Do you have that kind of mindset, or is it just me?
So I don't know for sure that I had it yet. So my son had it and my stepson had it, and I'm actually getting an antibody test tomorrow to confirm whether I had it. But yes, no, I totally, I mean, I can say that by proxy, like with my son, now that he's had it, it is, I mean, I'm not glad he had it. And if I could go back, I would have him not get it. But, you know, it is a little bit of a sigh of relief. Like, he hadn't seen my parents in months, and he has a special relationship with my mother. And it was really hard on both of them. And just to be able to send, I mean, he still wears a mask just out of an abundance of caution. But even to be able to send him over to their house for a couple hours here and there is really makes me feel like, wow, okay, we're moving in the right direction here. So there is a silver lining.
Yeah, it's it is interesting. I will tell you that, and I don't mean to make light of COVID, because it obviously is very deadly. You always got to have a little bit of a disclaimer, but we've been in this now almost a year, and a lot of us are just weary. So you got to at least talk about it and make fun, I guess, because you're too tired not to. And so I will say that during our COVID experience, both my son and I loved it, because it was like we were sitting up there in our respective rooms, because we were being quarantined to our rooms. My wife would not let us get out of our rooms, so she had to wait on us hand and foot. It was as if we had our own little bell we just rang. Hey, I would like a refill on my whatever. Please come up here. And she would do that because she did not want us moving about the house for fear that she would get COVID. And so, yeah, for my son and I, it was a vacation. I mean, it was, you know, 10 days in our room with a great maid service. And then, of course, it did not end well, because on the 10th day, guess who came down with COVID?
Your wife.
What? My wife. Despite her best efforts to stay away from us and to keep us in our rooms. So she waited on us hand and foot. And right when we got out, she got it.
Wait, you wait on her hand and foot? Like, you must have reciprocated.
And see, no, we didn't have to, because we had already had it. She did not have to be quarantined to a room. It didn't matter where she was.
Terminating this podcast. Like, oh my gosh, the patriarchy. I can't even, like, even this virus is a misogynist. I can't even believe it. Because it was the same in my house. Like, I'm the one who can work from home. Like, my husband can't work from home. And he had tested negative and, you know, was okay to, he's very isolated at work. So he was okay to go to work. So here I am at home waiting on my son and my stepson hand and foot for days on end. And I'm like, this is so unfair. Like, why?
It is interesting. But all right, well, enough of that. Obviously, COVID played a huge part in this last year. We don't have to review that, though. It is interesting to kind of think, where were we as a society 12 months ago as we were just entering it? I think you and I mentioned there is a little bit of COVID fatigue now. The things that we did, you know, at the very beginning of this, and now we're over it for the most part. Just last week, I went to Walmart to buy some vegetables, and you know how we always fight with those stupid plastic bags?
Hate those plastic bags.
Oh, it's maddening. I mean, that's probably one of the worst things about this. You can't have any kind of moisture on your fingers, so you're fighting those dang plastic bags, and you're ripping them up, you're cussing, you're cursing, whatever. And this last week, I just gave up, and I licked my fingers, and I opened up those plastic bags. I guess I just forgot. I lost my senses, and I went ahead and did that. And I don't know. Maybe that's a mistake. We shouldn't be over it. We should be extra vigilant, because it's not over yet. But It was a very fascinating year. So let's just jump right in. The last year, let's do a review. What were the big legal stories? Any cases from the last year stand out to you?
Well, I mean, obviously, in terms of recency, the election lawsuits were a huge one. And I think there were all told about 5 dozen of them. So that was like
5 dozen.
So that was huge. And it's a saga that's still going on and won't be resolved until, I guess, this week. Although at this point, like, I will kind of believe it when I see it. Like, I'm just won't rest easy until inauguration day. So, you know, we'll have to wait a couple more weeks for that. But I think that the election cases were a huge one, at least for me. But there were, you know, there were a lot of like legal goings on, and it's almost surprising because the world did shut down for so long, but you know, it didn't slow us down in terms of the justice system. So there was a lot that happened.
Well, let's talk about those election lawsuits. That obviously was the big deal from this last year. And it was a particular interest to me because I have personally been involved with election lawsuits. I lived in Florida back in 2000 when you had the Bush v. Gore and you had the hanging chads, and I was personally involved in those lawsuits. And so I got to witness it on that end. And you can go back and re-listen to the podcast in my daily updates that I do every day, three times a week or so. I'm on the record. I said this from the very beginning. These election lawsuits are about nothing. Courts will never overturn the votes of the people. They might, you know, say, hey, there was a little bit of fraud here, the proper procedures were not followed. But after the votes have been counted, I am unaware of a single case where a court threw out votes, and especially of this magnitude. We're talking about the president of the United States. They're not going to do it. And so, as you know, that's exactly what happened. There has been no evidence of wide-scale fraud, at least to the point of changing the votes of the election. And so, of course, the Supreme Court did not get involved in this case. Did that surprise you that the Supreme Court did not jump in?
No, it didn't. And, you know, I followed some of the lawsuits more closely than others, but like anybody who knows what, you know, a motion to dismiss is or what the standards for pleading, especially fraud, like under the federal rules and most state rules, like it's a higher standard for pleading because you're accusing someone of fraud. So anyone who is, you know, versed in that aspect of the law would never give these lawsuits a second thought. But I think, you know, it's very interesting and scary to me, at least, how we've seen that the legal system, it worked. And I think we've said that on prior episodes, like the justice system worked. The Rule 12 motions were appropriately granted and motions to dismiss were granted. And, you know, there was no evidentiary basis. And so the lawsuits were dismissed and all of that worked. And we should be proud that we have, you know, a justice system that works so well. However, at the same time, we've seen in this age of constant media attention and social media and people being able to make things into a meme that they then spread, how these lawsuits and the justice system generally have been used to kind of perpetuate a narrative outside of, you know, the factual narrative that takes place inside the courtroom. So that to me is, I feel like we've kind of lost our ability to evaluate the relative merit of information, if that makes sense. Like, it's almost like a critical thinking skill. Like, I had someone who's very well educated and very smart say to me, like, oh, well, I'm not going to get the COVID vaccine. And I said, oh, well, can I ask why? And they said, well, I heard that it changes your cells. And I said, well, yeah,
that's what a vaccine is.
Like, a vaccine changes your cells in that it makes them able to fight against this virus. Like, you want it, you don't want it to not change your body, then it wouldn't do anything. So, you know, people, I feel like that, and it's the same with the election lawsuits. Well, I heard that there was, you know, fraud here. And it's like, well, what's the source of that information? And does the person telling you have a motive, maybe, or are they biased in some way? Or, you know, we've lost our ability to kind of evaluate the merits of this. And luckily, it seems like in the courtroom, you know, the rules of procedure and evidence are there to force the fact finder to evaluate the merits of information, right? Like, that's why you can't have hearsay. But we need to bring that outside of the courtroom and kind of think about that in our lives.
That's a very important distinction that you just made, and that is there's a lot of talk on TV and press releases and on podcasts about all the fraud that's going on, and yet we get that. There's a lot of talk out there. But when you're in court, and especially when you're making a fraud allegation, you got to, what's known in legal circles as plead with particularity. You have to spell out where the fraud is. And that's where the court system did its part. In other words, okay, we know there's allegations in the media, but we're in court now. Give us your facts. Where is the fraud? And there just wasn't any, at least not on a scale to overturn votes. And so that was where the legal strategy failed. Now, my main takeaway from the whole election lawsuits is I was disappointed in the media's response to the lawsuit filed at the U.S. Supreme Court by the Texas Attorney General. I thought of all the different lawsuits, that one actually had merit. But yet, here's what you did not see. You did not see any talking head out there analyze the merits of the case. One guy you even follow is David French. And he really disappointed me because he said, look, there's absolutely no merit. And the Supreme Court agreed there was no merit. But he used merit in a very flippant way, saying you weren't going to be successful. That's a different thing than merit under the law. When you would say the lawsuit was not going to be successful, I would agree with that because of standing. I don't think that this lawsuit was brought at the right time for the court to provide meaningful relief. But, and here's my big takeaway, is I do think in 4 years from now, you are going to see that argument be made and courts will address it, but these will have to be filed as pre-election lawsuits, so pre-enforcement challenges, not after the votes have been taken, but before the election takes place. And then I think if these lawsuits would have been filed then, you might have had a different outcome. Any thoughts on the Supreme Court election lawsuit?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it was a bold move for sure. And it was a Hail Mary. But it's different in that, you know, this wasn't a fraud case. Right. So it was basically
right.
My understanding is it was Texas and then some other states joined in basically saying like, hey, these other states changed their laws and it violated
right.
basically their own law, the way that they allowed people to vote. And it had the effect.
It violated the Constitution. The Constitution spells out how you are to choose your electors, and that has to be done by the state legislature. So that is, for lack of a better word, the contract all the states agreed to, right? The 13 colonies, they agreed to that contract. Everyone that became a state, those are our governing rules. If you are, and we all care about the electors because Texas cares, Maryland cares, Virginia cares, because that's electing the president of the United States that's going to rule over Texas, rule over Maryland, rule over Virginia. So they care about that. And these various states were changing their election procedures without going through the state legislatures. And so that violated the U.S. Constitution. I think that has merit if that had been brought pre-election.
Yeah. And I don't, you know, I think there is a real issue that it's not all like, oh, there was never any issue this year. It was just a regular election. Nothing changed. There was nothing new. And this is all ridiculous. Like there were major changes in election law and procedure because of the pandemic. And I think there is a real issue about, you know, what are states allowed to do in this kind of emergency situation that's, you know, very rare and it's time sensitive, obviously, where people can't
right.
come out. I mean, individuals also have a fundamental constitutional right to vote. And if you are 90 years old in a nursing home, like you have no less of a right to vote than
right.
anybody else. And so there is kind of a tension there. And I think there's, you know, there is space for debate there. I think And I hear you, what you're saying with the way the media treated this. I think by the time we got there, it was just, there was so much refuse to like weed
right.
through to even get to that like kernel of a real issue that people were just
right.
so tired of even dealing with it. It was like, we know what the result is. It's not changing.
Yes.
This is lawsuit number 61. Like, let's move
exactly.
on.
Exactly. And you cannot bring a lawsuit of that magnitude after the vote has happened. I'm just telling you, that is a non-starter. You are not going to see any court, let alone the U.S. Supreme Court, overturn of a vote of the people like that. It's just not going to happen. All right. I do want to put you and I on the spot here because we are recording this on a Monday night of this week. On Wednesday of this week, the electoral votes will be in and the vice president will open up the ballots and read and count those votes. So by the time this podcast airs on Friday, we're all going to know what kind of shenanigans are going to be pulled. The circus that is going to happen on Wednesday. Any thoughts as to what we're going to see happen come this Wednesday?
I would be remiss to even make a prediction, I think. You know, it really, I know there's been a lot of hyperbole and a lot of alarmism and gun sales spiked prior to the election. And I don't, yes, by a lot, I think. And I, you know, I don't want to add fuel to the fire and I don't want to be any part of that. However, listening to the president's phone call with the Georgia Secretary of State that was recorded and then hearing that, you know, several or not even several, several dozen representatives and even senators are going to object to certifying the Electoral College results.
Right, right.
That is alarming to me.
Hold on a second. Let's just pause.
That.
Let's just pause right here because I do want to unpack this phone call to the Georgia Secretary of State because that's another phone call that I think it's interesting to me because it's highly misrepresented in the media. So I decided to listen to the phone call for myself and read the transcript. And yeah, it's being butchered again. That being said, this phone call is the entire Trump presidency all wrapped up in a one-hour call. I mean, this is classic Trump, right? I mean, first of all, the essence of this call was Trump calling up the state of Georgia saying, look, I think there's fraud in your elections. Oh, really? Mr. President, where? Where is the fraud? Well, it's in these voting machines or these suitcases or I hear. It's like, no. Sorry, Mr. Trump. Sorry, Mr. President. We've looked into those. There is no fraud there. Well, I need you to find for me 11,000 votes. And that's what the media is just jumping on, that somehow Trump is trying to pressure the Georgia Secretary of State into finding enough votes for him to win the election. But I don't think that's what he did at all. I think what he did was he is convinced that there was fraud because how else could he lose? In fact, he even said this. He said, count all the thousands of people that attended my rallies and then look at the few hundred who attended Biden's. Clearly, I am the winner. No, it's just that your followers are a little bit, they're willing to attend these huge rallies and Biden's supporters were not willing to, whatever. but nonetheless, according to Trump, he thought there was fraud. And so he wanted, because there was voting irregularity, he didn't care about that. He just cared about the voting irregularity that caused him to lose. And so he wanted them to look into the voter irregularity, but he was kind enough to say, after you find 11,000 improperly voted votes, you can go ahead and stop. That's all I care about. I don't care if they're committing fraud. I just don't want to lose the election. Any thoughts on that?
I mean, you know, so I hear a lot, and especially at the beginning of his presidency, I feel like I heard a lot of people say, oh, that's just Trump. Like, that's just
yes,
how he is. And I don't disagree with that. I would just add that when you voluntarily endeavor to and then succeed at becoming the leader of the free world, you have a fiduciary constitutional and moral obligation not to be that way.
Like, I know.
You can't be that way because of the position that you have chosen to assume. So that's my, I mean, I do think that is, and you know, I've always kind of said, I don't think that Donald Trump is the epitome of evil. Like, he's not Sauron, he's not Adolf Hitler. I think he is totally unqualified, totally ignorant about our nation's history, our founding document, and how the structure of government is supposed to play out. And I think that that is a breach of those aforementioned duties. And therefore, he should not be in that office. Like, that's my feeling. And I don't, it's just my personal opinion. And I know people feel very strongly one way or another.
Right.
But I do think, you know, the genius of our system is that it's set up in such a way, and the genius of having federalism and all of that is that, yeah, I mean, typically when you are a fiduciary, you do, you know, in the law, you can be found to be pressuring someone more easily. For example, like a, you know, a boss can pressure a subordinate more easily, right, or a doctor can pressure a patient. You have to be more careful, right? But I think the beauty of our system, too, is when you have, for example, the Georgia Secretary of State, he's not really answerable to the president. He's answerable to the people of the state of Georgia. And right, so it's kind of a beautiful thing that we have, and most countries, I think, don't have this, and we shouldn't take it for granted that we have, you know, elected officials in each and every state who can just be like, no, Mr. President, you are wrong, and I don't answer to you, and this is the way we're doing it, and it's our election, and deal with it. And that's great. So, you know,
maybe we should do an episode just geared solely to the genius or the insanity of President Trump. Because I got to tell you, I don't know which way it goes. I mean, from the very beginning, you know, 5 years ago when he was running for presidency, I thought he was an idiot. I thought he has no idea what he's doing. And then he kept winning. And then he kept winning. And all of us that were saying he doesn't know what he's doing, then we're looking at ourselves like, well, maybe we don't know what we are saying, because this guy, he has a strategy, and he's winning. And then he won the day and won the election. And then in your mind, you thought, okay, now he's going to get it. Now he's going to act presidential. He has this beautiful opportunity to really pursue the American dream and to be president. No, it didn't live out that way. He kept the campaign Trump going all the way through the presidency. Now, I do think other presidents have done that as well, like Obama. I would definitely say was campaign Obama all throughout. He was just a little bit smarter in how he did it and didn't make the mistakes so glaringly like Trump did. Trump was more like in your face with his mistakes. Like, I'm Trump, so I don't really care. I don't know. All right, one last thought before we move on to our next storyline. What is going to happen over the next 2 weeks? Is he going to leave peacefully? Is there going to be some kind of fireworks as he's being ushered out of the White House? I got to tell you, at this point in time, I don't know how this is going to play out at all. I'm clueless. Do you want to put yourself on the record of having any idea on how this transition is going to happen?
I mean, I don't think he's probably going to be particularly classy about it. I would be surprised if he had to be dragged out kicking and screaming, because I don't think that's good for his image. And I think he's very image conscious.
Right.
So I hope that, you know, the fear of looking weak will, you know, prevent him from doing anything like that. But, you know, I mean, so if you
will
call
he
me,
attend? Yeah. Will he attend the inauguration?
Oh,
of
I
Biden.
Wouldn't be surprised if he didn't.
See, that I agree with you. I think his ego might say, I'm moving out the day before. I'm going to be gone. I'm going to be back in Florida, wherever he wants to go, maybe somewhere even outside of the United States. I don't know. I would be surprised to see him at the inauguration. But then again, maybe he will. Some people say if he shows up at the inauguration, it'll usurp Biden's day. So I don't know. I do know he'll be criticized no matter what he does, because it's also been the media's role in this. All right, well, let's move on now to some of the better, more interesting cases from this last year. I think you and I both can agree that one of the precedent-setting cases was the toilet bowl licking incident. Are you familiar with that case?
It will go down in the history books. I mean, definitely like a bellwether case.
Can you believe that there actually was a headline this year over the legal ramifications of someone licking the toilet bowl on an airplane? I guess you cannot sum up 2020 better than that.
And, you know, like, hasn't the person suffered enough? Like, what kind of, I mean, I think you have to take an insanity defense at that point, because what kind of a sane person? I don't even like to go to the lavatory in an aircraft. Like, those things are gross.
Yeah. Oh, no kidding. And you're gonna lick it? And then to make matters, but I do think this sums up 2020 because of our paranoia with the coronavirus. Again, at the very beginning, we Purelled our entire body before we stepped into a grocery store, and then we bathed ourselves throughout the grocery store. And then when we left, we had another shower of Purell just to make sure we were all clean. I think kind of we have a corona fatigue, but at some point in time in this whole process, someone decided to lick a toilet bowl. And so a prime prosecutor thought that this could be a terrorist act. Does that surprise you? I know you used to be a former prosecutor. Can you see some terrorism going on in licking a toilet bowl when one might have COVID virus?
I mean, I can see. So I don't know about the jurisdiction where this occurred, but in Pennsylvania, terroristic threats is, it's actually a misdemeanor. And it basically
really?
Means, yeah, it's the word terrorism is in there, but I don't think it necessarily has to do with that. It's basically like terrorizing another person in a threatening okay. way. So you can, like, essentially, if you say, you know, I'm going to kill you, and there are certain things that you can do that would be considered making a terroristic threat. I think that's a reach here. I see more of like a disorderly conduct scenario. Like disorderly conduct, there's a catch-all, like, you know, you're engaging in behavior that serves no legitimate purpose, and it's like sort of probably unconstitutional, but like it's, you know, as applied, like it's just used for, you know, conduct that's disorderly that could put other people in harm's way or cause a disturbance. So I see it more of like a citation type of scenario, but you've seen a lot of these, and they're, you know, with social media, especially, I remember at the beginning of the pandemic, people thought it was hilarious to go on TikTok and, like, you know, cough on other people or, you know, lick things in the grocery store and put them back on the shelves. Like, I don't know whether there was just some collective insanity or whether I'm just too old to like realize that this is funny, but like to me it's not funny, and I don't know what people are thinking. And I personally have no problem if people who do that are getting cited for disorderly conduct. You know, a felony is probably too much, but you know.
Now we probably can both agree though that if this case had been pursued, the insanity defense would have been an easy defense in this case because what sane person would put their tongue on a toilet seat lid? All right, well, let me give you what are my three potentially precedent-setting cases, and then I want to just quickly have you offer your comment on the case, and then also whether or not you think that it's going to set precedent. The first one is the Nick Sandman defamation lawsuits. Do you remember what that case was involving? This Nick Sandman was a high school student, was there at the National Mall, and there was a Native American there who approached him, and so there's a Native American activist named Nathan Phillips, and this is all recorded in CNN, all these different, you know, Washington, these media publications ran with this story, this narrative that these punk teenagers were so disrespectful to this Native American activist and they should be ashamed and they're wearing red MAGA hats and so they just were the dreg of society. Do you remember that whole storyline, that whole narrative?
I do. It seems like forever ago. I can't even believe that was 2020. But yes, I do remember it.
This year. And as we then soon, so that narrative ran for several days. And then it came out that, well, wait a second. Actually, these kids did nothing. These kids were just there minding their own business. And the others approached them, taunting them. But that did not stop CNN and the others from running with their narrative for several days. And so here was the lawsuit. A defamation lawsuit was filed against CNN, NBC Universal, New York Times, CBS News, ABC News. Basically, every media company out there ran with this narrative. Even after they had information that it was untrue, they still ran with that narrative. And so this is why I think that this settlement is precedent setting.
Yeah.
I think the media has some liability. It has been suggested that the media has a narrative, a political narrative, and we all know that. You'd be sticking your head in the sand if you do not recognize that the media has a political narrative. And here they pursued it to the detriment of a teenage boy. And so should the media be liable? Do you think this lawsuit and these settlements will change the course of reporting by these major media companies?
Well, I don't know in terms of precedent because, right, we don't have like a big opinion that's been handed down by an appellate court on these issues.
Right.
But I do think, you know, and I'm not an expert in defamation, either perpetrating or handling defamation cases. But I do think, you know, there should be a difference between reporting on something and commentating on something. So, you know, it's kind of the lines are starting to be, or maybe not even starting, but the lines are getting blurred between, you know, what is reporting the facts, like saying, oh, there was a disturbance involving these high school students that happened at the National Mall today, and here's some video. Like, that wouldn't defamatory, right?
Right. I want to just pause there because I think you hit on, though, where the loophole is, because this is what happens. Everyone is in a rush for their headline, right? And since we all have instantaneous news on Twitter, on social media, there is a rush that you got to come out with your headline. And so here's what will happen. Some other company, let's just say some fly-by-the-night company, will run with this video and this headline of these teenage boys mocking this Native American. All right, so then CNN and the big dogs, they just report that as their headline, reported that teenage boy is a punk, right? Should they be allowed to get away with sloppy journalism without actually doing some fact-checking just simply by saying someone else reported it? Because that's how they're getting around these.
Right.
So, oh, no, we're not saying this actually happened. We're just saying someone reported that it happened so we can get our headline. And I'm going to call BS on that. I think that they should be held liable. Now, as a First Amendment lawyer, I don't know how that might come to be. But I definitely see the problem there because there is no rush to actually ascertain the facts of a situation, to double fact check it. They don't even single fact check it. If someone reported it, they run with it, as they did in this story. So I am actually kind of happy to see some lawsuits in the $1 million range where it actually hurts the pocketbook of these major media companies. If they're going to rush to judgment on these type of stories and hide behind that, oh, someone reported it, I think they should pay out. But I don't know. It definitely is a problem in my mind. Any other thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely is a problem, but I also think, and maybe it's easy for me to say because I'm not anyone who has, knock on wood, so far had my life ruined by false reporting. So,
right.
You know, maybe I would feel differently otherwise. But I also think, you know, there is some value, and maybe, you know, not for most people yet, but I remember that this occurred around the same time as the Jussie Smollett incident in Chicago.
Yes.
And I did kind of have a knee-jerk reaction to reading news reports about both of those incidents. And
what do you mean by that? Spell that out. What was your initial reaction to both of those instances? So Jussie Smollett reported that he was attacked on the streets of Chicago, 2 a.m., going to get a subway, whatever. What was your initial reaction?
Well, both of these incidents had to do with Trump, right? Like Nick Salmon, they were wearing MAGA hats. And in the Jussie Smollett, it was, yeah, they were, you know, it was a racist attack that they were saying,
and
like Trump country or something. And I had, you know, it fed into my emotional feelings about Trump. And so I tended to, I think my initial, like, luckily I'm not a person who, you know, goes on Facebook, oh my gosh, I can't. So I didn't really like publicize my reaction, but internally, like my emotional reaction was, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. This is horrible. And, you know, I can't believe people would do this. And as it turns out, you know, people didn't do that. Or at least, you know, there was never any evidence that the evidence was that he fabricated it. So I did learn that, you know, I need to be better in terms of critical thinking skills, which I've just disparaged the greater population for not employing. And I am, you know, maybe the pot calling the kettle black. But, you know, I learned that I really need to wait and see and kind of get all the facts before making a judgment about anything really that's in the news. And it has changed the way I consume news, for sure. And I, so I do think there is, you know, some...
We're cynical now, right? If
we're cynical
see something
now,
on
but
the
that's
news,
okay. Like, let's let it play out, and then maybe hopefully people will become more savvy to like what's going on in the media environment and learn to have those critical thinking skills. Whereas if we just like shut it down with lawsuits, you know, maybe we're not, maybe the marketplace of ideas like really isn't playing out. So I don't know. I mean, it's hard for me to like be like, yay, censorship.
Right, right. We'll have to see how this plays out, because I definitely think this could be precedent setting. At least I hope that the journalists now start to actually fact check their storylines. I do know there's going to be a rush to the headline because everyone wants to get the headline first. But hopefully there is a little bit more fact checking going on. And if they don't do the fact checking, then they're going to have to pay the price. But I guess in a nutshell, maybe I skipped this. In your own mind, when you first heard about the Nick Sandman story, again, this is the essence of the defamation. Did you think less of Nick Sandman when you first heard that story?
I mean, yeah. So he was what, like 15? I remember that my initial reaction was, what kind of a school lets its kids walk around the National Mall in MAGA hats on a school trip? Like, I really was annoyed with the school more than anything. Just, I think because I have kids around that age, like I didn't put too much stock into judging what appeared to me at the time, wrongfully so, to be just like a stupid teenager acting like a stupid teenager. But I can totally see how people would and how he would, you know, have a harder time applying to colleges and all of that stuff. I mean, I can totally see how that would have happened.
Okay, next precedent-setting case, and I gotta let me give me a little bit of time here to say why I think it's a precedent-setting case, is the Trump impeachment. Now, again, it does kind of show how this year has been a very long year to think that within the calendar year we've had the Trump impeachment trial. It's like, really? That was this calendar year? Yes, it was this calendar year. And so this was the, I believe, third impeachment trial of a sitting president. You had had the first one was Andrew Johnson. The second one was going to be Bill Clinton. And then this was the third one. And for those of you thinking, well, what about Nixon? It never went to trial. He resigned before it ever got to that point. But nonetheless, is this the new norm? I mean, it took our nation, what, from 1791 to 1997, I think, before we had our second impeachment trial, and now we've had two in the last 20-some years. Is this a trend? Is this now political? Whenever we have a House of Representatives controlled by one party and the president in the other party, are we going to have an impeachment proceeding now? Is this kind of like the common course modus operandi now of the political sphere? Any thoughts on that?
I hope not. I mean, I really hope not. And I think, you know, I've heard some end of the year commentary on podcasts and in the news talking about how, you know, the Mueller investigation revealed nothing and it was a complete waste of time. And like, let's hold on for a second, because the larger part of the Mueller report talked about Russian interference. And that was actually, like, I'm cool with my tax dollars having been spent on that, because that was really important. And it's still going on. And I think there needed to be an investigation, and we needed to learn all of that information. And we will have to keep dealing with this stuff moving forward. And in fact, several of our national agencies have been hacked, you know, recently. So obviously that was a very important issue. And I don't agree with anyone saying, you know, the whole Mueller report was trash and whatever. However, you know, I think more to your point, just having a divided government automatically leading to these kind of inquiries and, you know, lock her up and impeach, you know, the expletive. And I think people, you know, ordinary citizens should be very skeptical of their hard-earned tax dollars being spent over and over and over and over on these kinds of inquiries and proceedings. Like, it's not what the government is ideally supposed to be doing. Like, they're supposed to be making laws. And I don't think that this should be, I hope it's not a precedent, and I'm not okay with it being that on either side. Like, it's, you know, it's easy for me to say now, because obviously I don't want Biden to be investigated or impeached, but I believe, and I hope that I would feel the same way on the other side. Like, it's not, except for in the most egregious circumstances, which I think translates to high crimes and misdemeanors, like, it shouldn't be something that our government spends a lot of time doing, and it seems like they did. And you know, I mean, it's kind of easy to Monday morning quarterback, because they're, I guess, was insufficient evidence of collusion in order to render an indictment. So if it had turned out the other way, I'd probably be sitting here saying, like, oh, thank God they did this. And, you know, so.
Well, if you If you started with Clinton's impeachment, there actually was an actual crime that was at the undergirding of the undergirding of the Clinton impeachment. I mean, he actually did lie under oath during his, I believe it was the grand jury proceedings is what it was based on. The actual impeachment charge was what it was based on. So that was, that is obstruction of justice. As a lawyer, you would know you can't lie under oath. And now at this point, it really then becomes, well, what is this about? This really becomes more about, I don't like your policies. Now, I'm going to impress you here, but you should not be impressed. But a Laurentia Beria, who was one of the longest-serving secret police chiefs in Joseph Stalin's reign, he said this, show me the man and I'll show you the crime. Now, again, lest you are impressed, I actually just Googled that quote. I said, I know someone said it, so I just quickly went over to my Google, whatever. I typed in, show me the man and I'll show you the crime, and I found out that it was, yeah, one of Joseph Stalin's secret police chiefs who said that. But yeah, if you get an independent investigator and looking at any politician and the president, they're going to find a crime. I mean, they just will. You give them long enough, they'll find that crime. And so it becomes really a matter of political wills. If the House of Representatives is controlled by one party, I am afraid that from now on out, you are going to see impeachment proceedings at least being looked into. And so the first time that some person stumbles, you're going to have an impeachment proceeding brought against them. This might be precedent setting, or we could just excuse this away as being, oh, this is just the Trump effect. I don't know. I could go either way on it. It did happen with Clinton. And so, you know, he definitely was not on the same sphere as Trump as far as being hated by the masses. I don't know. Any thoughts? Is this going to be the new norm?
Yeah, I mean, I hope it was kind of the Trump effect and that this won't continue. And I do think, and I hope, and maybe I'm more optimistic than the average person because I'm not on social media, so I don't see, you know, what goes on. But I do hope and think that there's like a collective feeling of, you know, this kind of divisiveness has got to stop. Like, we have to start moving in the right direction. And it seems like we, most of us kind of want to get there. We just disagree on the way. Like, we all want to say, you know, it's like when President Obama said, like, of course I'll work with Republicans right. if they have good ideas. And it's like, but, exactly. you know, they all have to be my ideas. The unspoken undertone to that. And I think we all kind of feel that way. Like, oh, if these crazy people on the other side could just see the world exactly the way I see it and agree with all of my ideas, then everything would be fine. And we all have to kind of, you know, stop and say, okay, like, that's not going to happen. We have to find a way to be pragmatic and work right. with each other, even if we strongly disagree. And we have to, even if we don't agree with the way someone else sees an issue, we have to at least say, okay, I can see that that's a sincere viewpoint, and I respect that it, right. you sincerely feel that way. And if we can just start there, like, maybe we can move in the right direction. But, you know, I'm over-optimistic. I don't know.
I think you are. My prediction is this is precedent setting, and now every single time some president missteps, the opposing party is going to try to appoint a special independent prosecutor to look into that issue. And even if it doesn't directly tie into the president, as long as it tangentially relates to it, it'll move in that direction. I just see this as being the new norm now. All right. How about this one is also, I think, a huge precedent setting case. Facebook's antitrust lawsuit. We talked about this here a month ago or so. Facebook has gotten too big for its britches, and so the federal government has brought in several states have brought antitrust lawsuits against Facebook because they are trying to eat up all their competitors and become too big. I think social media has gotten out of control in this country. And I think it has gotten to the point where it is a significant problem. And I think they're going to look to take Facebook down. I could be totally wrong on that one. Any thoughts on Facebook's antitrust lawsuit?
Yeah, I think this is going to be a huge legal issue moving into 2021. And I mean, that's basically the reason why I'm off social media. I agree with you. I think it's I don't know if I want to say unethical because I'm not like the arbiter of that, but it's disturbing to me that, you know, I can open my page and then someone else next to me can open their page and we can search for the same thing and you have different results. And it's not a mystery why, you know, we all have these totally different views of what's going on in the world when we're not working off the same set of information. And it's these companies, and there's only a handful of them that are really controlling all of this. And it is, I mean, it is disturbing when you really kind of start digging into it. And especially when you hear the testimony of some of the former executives from these companies that have left and their kind of whistleblowing testimony to Congress. So I think this is going to be a huge legal issue moving forward. Oh. I know nothing about antitrust law. I know that it started with Teddy Roosevelt. That's like pretty much the extent of my knowledge.
Paid attention in history class.
Yes, there was a graphic in my U.S. history book about the trust buster. So I remember that, but I'm not versed in that area of the law, so I can't comment on like how, you know, what the chance of success of these lawsuits are. But it seems like it's, you know, fairly well thought out and joined by a lot of, you know, important states and people. So we'll see.
I don't think you need to know the specifics. You just need to know the general concepts behind antitrust law. You can't become too big for your britches. I'm not sure that's actually a legal quote, but there's a citation for it. But that actually is the essence of the law. If you become too big, you have too much control. You can set prices. You can control the market. You squash out competition. We value competition in America. We really do believe that's the lifeblood of a vibrant economy. And these social media companies have become just huge, and it's having all kinds of problems. Just look at this last election, where they definitely put their thumb on the scale of this election, and with like an anvil on the side of against Trump, and it could have decided the election. And I think that there's going to be a payback for that, because even though the Democrats now might like that because of the result in that their candidate won, it just as quickly can go against them the next time around. And so it is a problem that has to be solved. When social media puts their thumb on that, the election scale, to the degree that they can, and with no immunity, just take the most recent example of where they decided to silence all discussion about the Hunter Biden's laptop, just because, not that there was anything untrue about it, it was all 100% factually accurate. They didn't like the implications of that. They go, oh, well, we know what Trump is going to say because of this, and we don't like that. Therefore, we are going to censor the actual facts of the matter. That's scary. I don't care what side of the party you're on. That is scary for a giant like social media, Facebook, Twitter, to be able to decide those kind of critical thoughts. And yeah, that impacts how people think when it comes to election.
100%. And it's like what I said about the Sandman case. Like, it's, you know, I'm not cool with censorship, and I feel like this is censorship, and it's preventing people from accessing information. And, you know, I think I am a lifelong Democrat, so I think the Hunter Biden, you know, storyline was a load of malarkey. But like, if it's a load of malarkey, then bring it, right? It's just like, it's the same thing as the election lawsuits. Like, if you got evidence of fraud, like, bring it on. Let's get it all, put everyone's cards on the table, and then we can assess based on the actual facts and circumstances. But when you start wanting to hide things, it's like, well, there's a natural human reaction. Well, people who have nothing to hide nothing. So if you're hiding stuff from us, like, what, there must be something there. There must be something true. And, you know, that's the natural reaction. And you can't blame people for having that reaction. So I'm totally on board with you on this one.
All right. Let's now go over to the Supreme Court. You know, obviously this last year was a very interesting time to be a Supreme Court observer, the first time in their history that their proceedings were done via Zoom and were broadcast so that everyone could listen to it in real time, not just the few hundred that were able to squeeze in like a can of sardines there at the Supreme Court building. And that brought us Fleshgate. Do you remember Fleshgate from this past year? Possibly one of the biggest controversies in the history of the Supreme Court.
Oh, yes. I will never forget it.
Yeah. Barr v. American Association of Political Consultants, i.e. the robocalls case. During the middle of arguments, someone flushed their toilet. Rumor is it might have been Biden. We don't know, but yeah, that's pretty interesting. They kind of forgot about that mute button. I think they now have known about the mute button. But looking back over this last year, what would be your one or two best or most important storylines from the Supreme Court this last year?
Well, losing RBG, like for sure, above and beyond anything else. I mean, I think that is, and it's really unfortunate too that it happened in such an eventful year where there was so much else going on, because I really think that, you know, there's so much more of her story that we all should know. And I would encourage everyone to, you know, read as much as you can about her, see the movie. And, you know, she really was an amazing jurist and an amazing lady. And, you know, losing her was a huge loss for our country and for the court. And I think that above and beyond anything else was, you know, obviously the most momentous thing that happened this year. And, you know, I am lucky to have, you know, studied her during law school and kind of gotten to follow her in the later part of her career, and definitely will never forget, you know, the path she kind of blazed for women, and really not even just women, like all attorneys. I mean, she was like a kick-ass lawyer. She really was. And so I think she's, you know, it was a huge loss.
Now, again, I like RBG for a lot of different reasons. Probably the most important reason from my perspective, because I don't agree with her when it comes to her judicial rulings and things like that. But I do think that there is a huge value in our civic discourse to learn how to disagree agreeably. And the fact that her and Scalia fought tooth and nail over almost every significant political issue out there, and then went to the opera together at night and played cards and just were friendly. I mean, man, do we ever need that in our society today? Yes, we can disagree with one another. Nothing wrong with that. But we can do it in a civil manner. And so I will tell you, I don't know if this sounds morbid. I hope I'm not being disrespectful to the whole issue here. But it is interesting to note that when I went over that episode a year ago when you and I were doing our resolutions, you remember that? What I didn't play for you, I cut it off, is I then commented on RBG, where I said, if you want to do a workout, Google RBG's workout regime, and you'll see she's doing planks and push-ups. And I said this, I said she had just fought and beat back cancer for the fourth time. And apparently it wasn't a complete victory. As we know, a couple months later, she then got it again and then passed away from it. And so for all those of us, and I lost my father from cancer in a 3-month span, it's vicious. I mean, it could rear its ugly head, and within months, it's just a very vicious condition. So yeah, the RBG was a very fascinating story, not just for losing an icon like her, but then she was replaced by the amazing ACB, Amy Coney Barrett. Now, I'm going to give you my take on this and then get your response. I'm hoping I'm not going to say the wrong thing. And if I do say the wrong thing, then hopefully I'll be smart enough to delete it. But nonetheless, here's why I like Amy Coney Barrett. Because she is not RCB. Or RGB. In other words, there was this idea amongst female circles, again, those that I'm not female, but I talked to some, you know, that in order to be a real female, you got to be like RGB. RBG. You got to be like her. In other words, she is the epitome of what it means, so that if you're not like her, then you're not a feminist. And I just think that that's wrong. I think you can be a feminist as a liberal and you can be a feminist as a conservative. Just because ACB's view of what it means to pursue women's rights might disagree with RBG's doesn't make her right or wrong. In fact, I think it's the equality of opportunity that is the key. Any thoughts on that?
I mean, I definitely don't disagree with that. And I think, you know, RBG came about in an age of like first wave feminism, right? And there really was only one way to be a feminist, because it was like the first kind of, I mean, I guess the suffrage movement, but it was, you know, we're very early in the kind of feminist civil rights era. And now, like, the fact that we can have someone like ACB on the court, and there was Sandra Day O'Connor before, but, you know, much more now, it does speak to the fact that we are in a different wave of feminism. And, you know, I welcome that for one. And I agree with you that it all has to do with having the freedom to make your own choices about the kind of person you want to be in the world. And there's not just one kind of woman. Like, we're all different individual people. I just think that, you know, I don't want to forget what it took to get here. And I don't think ACB does at all. I mean, I think she even said during her confirmation hearing, like, Justice Ginsburg really blazed a trail for women to be able to even have this position. And, you know, she definitely does not forget what it took to get here. Right. So as long as that's, you know, on our minds and we're not forgetting, then I'm all for it. And I think, yeah, of course, there are brilliant women conservative thinkers, and we need all kinds of people.
But there's this mindset that if you don't belong to the group think, then you are anti that group. For example, Clarence Thomas cannot be part of the African-American community because he is a conservative. That's not me saying that. You hear a lot of people out there say that Clarence Thomas is not a true African-American. And then you also hear stuff like similar thing about RBG. Unless you agree with her policies, you can't actually be for women's rights. Like ACB can't possibly be a true feminist. I actually recently, like in the last week, got railed on for, I did this this thing on my class where I would show these pictures of different Hollywood celebrities and compare them to Supreme Court justices. And so I had up on the screen a picture of RBG and Granny Clampett. And boy, did someone rail me over the coals for that one. It's like, how dare you put those two people up there? How dare you disgrace RBG by putting your picture alongside Granny Clampett? And my thought was, how dare you disgrace Granny Clampett? Why is Granny Clampett not also a real good example for women? I mean, she was depicted as being smart. And yes, she was from the hills. She's a hillbilly, but there's nothing wrong with that. And so just because you approach life from a different perspective doesn't make you right or wrong. It just is what it is. And so I think the reason why I like RBG is she did pave the way for equality. The problem I have is when you try to say only one kind of mindset is entitled to be heard, I think that's problematic.
Yeah, and I think, you know, again, it's a natural human tendency to want to categorize people and, you know, identify them as in the in-group or not in the in-group. And when it's, it doesn't conform exactly, there's like an alert that goes off in your limbic brain, right? Like your reptile brain, like alert, alert, does not belong. And, you know, I think what, like the anecdote you told about RBG and Scalia, like what that teaches us is, you know, it's part of our duty and our journey as human beings to try to like transcend that. And even though it's a natural instinct that occurs and that's okay, like we can acknowledge that like there is like a higher level of thinking that involves curiosity about other people's positions and, you know, wants to learn about why other people see the world the way they do and understands that like the value of different human experiences. And I think, you know, it's tough in a year like 2020 that was so isolating and kind of forced us all to retreat into our own little groups. It's tough to remember that that's part of what we're supposed to be doing here, like on Earth, is like trying to interact with each other on that level. But I hope that like somebody like ACB, who from everything I've seen, and time will tell, and I'm not going to judge, right, prejudge, but I think from everything I've seen, she seems to get that. And really everyone on the court right now seems to get that. Like, we do have people in leadership positions that can kind of show us the way in that regard. And I'm cautiously optimistic that even this 6-3 supermajority conservative court will do that most of the time. I mean, I'm not like totally naive. Like, I know there are probably going to be rulings that I'm very disappointed with, but I do hope that, you know, that kind of tenor shows us that, you know, we can do this in a civil way that, you know, in that respects kind of everyone's life experience and point of view.
I do think that this next year, I can't even predict what it's going to be like. I believe this is going to be ACB's court. I believe she's going to take control of this court. She's going to cast the deciding votes in a lot of decisions. And so it's going to be fascinating to watch. A couple things to look forward to this next year would be Obamacare final call. We know that case right now is pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. Are they going to strike down Obamacare? I think you and I are both in agreement. They will not. They'll find a way to keep it alive and just strike down the mandate as being unconstitutional, but that issue is before the Supreme Court. And who knows what this next year will bring. Again, I have a feeling it is going to disappoint a lot of conservatives. That is my gut feeling, is that a lot of conservatives are not going to be happy with the direction of the court this year, but they will
what
get some.
What about the affirmative action case, though? Like, that one, I feel like, might be like this huge landmark conservative victory. Don't you? You don't feel that way?
No. I mean, how could they rule on that case? I mean, on one, it all depends on what the court, how broadly the court rules on the affirmative action. Are they going to say that anytime race is used as a factor, it is automatically invalid if it's done by a university? It all depends on how broad that opinion is. When that case comes up, we'll definitely have to unpack it. Do you know when it's going to be argued?
I have no idea. I haven't even looked at the court's calendar for this term yet. So I'm behind the eight ball here. But we'll have to figure it out and, talk about that argument, because that's one that I'm very interested in. I first heard about that case, it's been 84 years, but I think a couple years ago at least. And it'll be, I'm very intrigued by it, because when I was in law school, it was right around when the Grutter and Gratz cases came out. And so, in my constitutional law class, we were really digging deep into that issue and, how the court was evaluating those cases. And I think, now it's been 10, 15 years and we're here again in a different context. And it's absolutely fascinating. And I think it's, you have the private school versus public school issue. And then you have, the government interest and the interest in having a diverse community that doesn't really, people have said like, oh, they used to have blind auditions for symphony orchestras, right? And, would you want them to have racial quotas if it meant that you were getting worse musicians? Like, nobody wants to hear subpar Beethoven, right? Like, you just want to hear the best Beethoven. But, it's a lot different in, like, when I send my kids to college, I do want them to be exposed to diverse viewpoints. And that's one of the most important aspects of going away to college, like meeting people who are totally different from you and learning how to live alongside them. Like, I think that's critical when you go to college. So there are different interests, and it's just, there's so much going on in those cases that, like, I am really on the edge of my seat. Like, that would be the one, if we're going to look forward to something in 2021 for the Supreme Court. Like, I'm really interested on how that one's going
to
turn out.
Wow. We're going to have to spend an entire episode unpacking that case. I do know, if my memory serves me correct, the last significant affirmative action case at the Supreme Court was maybe Fisher. And in Fisher, I believe the Supreme Court ruled again that you can't have hard quotas. Hard quotas are bad when it comes to affirmative action. But you can use affirmative action as a factor. It just can't be some kind of hard set quota. I guess that speaks to what you just said, that diversity in and of itself is valuable. And so if they want a broad, swell of representation of various races, and sexes at a certain college, then you can consider that, because you want that kind of broad, diverse student body, because there's value in diversity. At the same time, when it comes down to a hard quota, like you got to have 15.25%, so you're going to exclude someone because they're on the wrong side of that number, that's where the Supreme Court has a problem. They have a problem with hard quotas.
Right.
And if the case before the court this year, if it's going to challenge that aspect, it's going to say no, because the Chief Justice Roberts has said in the past, the way to end discrimination based upon race is to stop discriminating based upon race. And so What he's saying there is, look, when you use race as a factor, you are discriminating based upon race, one way or the other. If you say, hey, look, you got to have more of this one race, then by implication, you're saying we're going to have less of another race. And so the way to end discrimination based upon race is to end discrimination based upon race. Will that win the day? Today, with a 6-3 conservative court, I tell you what, we'll find out. We'll probably spend at least an episode or two just unpacking that case.
I can't wait.
It'll be interesting. One also wonders how the current cultural environment with the Black Lives Matter movement might impact that decision, because the court is very conscientious about the public's opinion, whether they should be or shouldn't be. They are. I mean, I do believe they stick their fingers out of the window to see which way the wind is blowing before they rule. I hope I don't get disbarred for saying that, but I think they do. They definitely consider the public, you know, support one way or the other before ruling. But we'll see how that comes out. Any other thoughts about the Supreme Court's term, either last year or the year to come?
I'm interested. I don't know if I could say, like, looking forward to, but I'm interested to see what this new court has in store. And I think, you know, after a year of such disruption and, you know, where so many of us have really been kind of thrown for a loop and it's been very disorienting, it's kind of comforting to know that even after losing probably its most famous and preeminent member, like the court marches on, and it's kind of like the British wartime saying, like, they keep calm and carry on and they just keep doing what they do. And it is, you know, if you're someone who follows the court, it is oddly comforting during these disorienting times. So I'm really looking forward to kind of just them getting back in the swing and us talking about it and, you know, amicably disagreeing.
Yes. Now, I am also interested in the Bostock case, the implications of the Bostock case. This is the case where the Supreme Court, in a 6-3 opinion, Gorsuch wrote the majority opinion, said that when it comes to Title VII, so the workplace, discrimination based upon sexual orientation and transgender status is discrimination because of sex, because sex is a necessary component in that determination, such that your employment decision would be the opposite if the sexes were opposite. Therefore, that is discrimination based upon sex, and so a violation of Title VII. And I am very curious to see how that decision plays out in two different respects. One would be female tennis, the professional tennis circuit. I believe if that decision is allowed to stand as it is, it could potentially destroy women's tennis. And so I also think that when it comes to Title IX sports, so when you're talking about sports in the college levels and high school levels, I think it also would necessarily end women's sports at the Title IX level, because during Title IX, there is no BFOQ exception that might apply in the employment context to save women's tennis. It definitely would not apply at the Title IX level. And so I do think that female tennis is subject to some kind of adverse consequence from that decision. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, typically this is part of, like, the genius of how our government works. So typically, like, if the government were functioning properly, you know, the court would kind of render this decision and then Congress would be like, oh, crap, like, we're going to have to rewrite this, or we're going to have to, like, amend this statute to, like, specifically address this issue that wasn't necessarily, not that there weren't transgender individuals when Title VII was written, but it wasn't something that was in the minds of the Congress people who drafted that legislation, right? So Congress is totally free at any point to take testimony from, like, in a hearing before amending this legislation or passing new legislation. Typically, people from, you know, who have experience with Title IX or people in the tennis world would come testify and say, like, this is the consequence that this is having and it's going to destroy the sport. And Congress would kind of have days and days of these people testifying and then say, okay, this is what we need to do and we're going to pass a law. So that's why when we were talking about the impeachment, I say, like, as a taxpayer, as a citizen, you should, you know, want your government to be legislating, to be making laws so that we don't, you know, we're not always at people. Everyone says, like, I don't want, you know, 9 lifetime tenure unelected judges. Well, they don't have to be dictating how we lead our lives. There's whole other branch of government that's like literally that's what they're supposed to be doing. So, you know, I think that it's quite possible that it would come to that. And I hope that our government can function enough to like pass some common sense legislation, because I feel like we've really gotten away from that, and that's what they're supposed to be doing. And when you like fill in that bubble to elect someone to Congress, like you should be voting for someone who will, you know, enact the types of legislation that you want to see enacted. That's how democracy is supposed to work. So, you know, I hear you on that one, and I think it definitely will have consequences. I don't know what they're probably unintended and unforeseen. So time will tell on that one, and we'll just have to see what happens.
Well, there you have it. It's been a really fascinating year, from licking toilet bowls to defaming people on CNN to women's tennis. This year covered it all. Who knows what next year is going to uncover? That's why people should subscribe to our podcast, so they will find out on a weekly basis all the interesting developments in the world of law. So, all right, thank you so much, Mackenzie, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom this entire operation would be a mess, Sean Wynn, and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do, Brooke Boland for spreading the good word about us, and Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.